Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support here at Advise. Look, I'm wearing my Pergam Integrity shirt, so you know that I'm here. And I've got my two partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from HHS OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director, and our payment integrity director here on our in-house SIU team, and Wade McFall, a retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG manager on our in-house team. So I want to talk today about an acronym that is somewhat incorrectly used in its name. It's known as the ADR, Additional Document Requests. And what got me going on this was last week on LinkedIn, I engaged with a lawyer who was representing a healthcare provider, and the lawyer was lamenting about the fact that they had received an ADR, additional documentation request, for a provider that she was representing, and it was 12,000 pages, is what it amounted to. So the first thing is, if you're looking to understand what ADRs or additional documentation requests are, you can go and check the trusty CMS PIM, Pergam Integrity Manual, Chapter 3, and you'll find all the information that you need to know about additional document requests, the guidance for them, some of the guidelines for them. It talks a lot about the MACs and the UPICs about that. Matt knows Chapter 3 like the back of his hand. He slept with the PIM under his pillow for osmosis purposes and knows about it. The reason I say it's a little bit of a misnomer is what it really is an initial document request. There may be subsequents that are additional, but it's really an initial document request that can come from a MAC. It can come from a UPIC, and even in, we're going to talk really very specifically today in the SIU space about these requests. It's essentially, sometimes it's known as the heralding letter, the request for records, whatever it may be. It's the impetus by which the payer makes a formal request for documents to the provider for a fraud, waste, abuse, or compliance purpose. Sometimes it may be from the compliance perspective. It could also be for educational and training purposes. You might find that records are being requested because there's an analysis being done by one of the HHS operating divisions, for example, trying to identify social determinants of health, or sometimes we can call them social detriments to health, right? If you don't have access to quality care and things of that sort. And so document requests come in many forms, but in the SIU space, it should be of no insignificance that SIUs do not conduct audits. They conduct investigational reviews or investigations. And so when requests for records come in from an SIU, it's for the purposes of an investigation, and whether that investigation results in an identification of an overpayment or referral to law enforcement or whatever, that's a separate piece of it. But they will always start with the record request. And again, it's a little bit of a misnomer when it's known as an ADR, because it may not be an additional documentation request unless you consider the submission of the claim, the initial document, and then other records. But what got me going in this conversation was the fact that 12,000 records for an audit from a UPIC, in this case it was, seems like a very high number when it's a non-institutional provider. So I started by asking this lawyer, were these records from a probe sample, a statistical sample, which? And she said it appeared to be a probe sample, not statistical. And I asked then, was it for an institutional provider? And she said no. And I said, well, that's a little bit of a head scratcher, because 12,000 records is a lot. But you have to think in terms of institutional versus regular providers. And Wade, I want to start with you, because you're doing a lot of these cases as part of our in-house manager on these cases. And one thing, you know, we always like to talk about when you're doing a probe sample, we always say Chapter 8 of the Pergam Integrity Manual talks about probe samples 20 to 40. We always say normally 30 is a good number. It's right in the middle. You can articulate why you're picking 30 versus Matt picking 20, me picking 30, you picking 40. There's a potentially a rhyme or reason. But you also have to think in terms of a few things. You have to think in terms of regulatory requirements. How long should this case take? How long could you go to make your determination? But more importantly is, how much do you bite off that you've got to chew? If you've got an institutional provider and you request 30 records, could those 30 records be 8,000, 10,000, 12,000 pages and then result in a six-month investigation? So considerations on this, regulatory issues, there's a lot to unpack when you're coming up with figuring out, are you requesting 30 records or some smaller number, and what are those considerations, particularly when you're talking about regulatory pieces of the puzzle?
Right, and you hit the main point there, and a lot of times it's hard to tell how many records you're going to get, and talking to the CPCs, the nurses may help you get a better overview on what to expect. But you're right, if you don't make that distinction, and you're just going with we always do 30. If it's institutional and it's going to be a ton of records, thousands of pages of medical records, you'll basically be shutting down one CPC for months, and all those other cases are just going to, they're going to be in the queue basically. So you have to look at it. It's like a completely different situation if it's an institutional multiple records, as opposed to, depending on what the provider specialty is, if you're going to do a sample of 30, whether it be 30 dates of services or 30 members for a certain procedure code, you're going to have a pretty limited number of records as opposed to the institutional. So that's the main thing. If you might have one CPC that's able to work a dozen or so cases to the end of the investigation and come up with an overpayment or not, as opposed to one CPC taking months for a record request that's kind of out of control, basically.
So, and let's talk about that for a minute, because that becomes the backlog. You could have 30 cases going on, and a large number of them are going to have a record review that needs to be done, an audit of the medical records by a CPC, an RM, whatever the level is that we're looking at. And so, the very first part that you talked about, which is really the most important part, is once you've understood kind of what it is that Wade McFall is doing for this case, is going back to an auditor and saying, what do you think this is going to look like from a volume perspective? If we're talking about a home health case or a hospice case, going back to one of the auditors that are conversant in those kinds of cases and saying, if I have someone who's been on hospice for 6 months, what are we looking at? Are we looking at 100 pages, 1,000 pages? And more importantly, is how long does something like that take to do, right? That actually gets back to this whole conversation that we always have about the interrelationship of your clinical auditing investigative teams, is having access to those people to ask those questions, because that's going to help drive a lot of where you're going to go, right? Are you requesting 30 or are you requesting 10?
Right. And I think it's important too to point out that a lot of times we'll have providers that, we talk about provider abrasion and things like that, but I've had providers that come back and say that we're trying to put them out of business, or we're being punitive when we have a review that results in like 100% overpayment. It's like we're really just trying to get like a comprehensive view on their billing practices and make sure that it's appropriate. And if it's not, those are funds that were paid out that should not have been. So you're paying back funds that you were never due in the first place. And a lot of times we'll have a review, and we will find that they're billing accurately and correctly, or there may be just a few one-offs, and we're not gonna, go to extra efforts to get a couple $100 or a couple $1,000. It's like if they're pretty much in line with what they should be doing, we might have some educational aspect to it, or we'll tell them, you're primarily billing correctly, but these couple tweaks you might want to make, you might want to be using this other code or whatnot. And that way they've been educated, so looking forward we shouldn't have the same problem. But the goal is not just to, I mean, granted, when there's overpayments that are due, and it's a blatant, it's 100% overpayment, everything was billed incorrectly, obviously we're going to collect that money. That's part of what we need to do. But also half the, maybe not half the times, but a lot of the times we find that they are billing correctly, and we just are going to give them that little bit of extra education so that down the road they're billing correctly, and we won't have
Right.
to review the same provider over and over for the same issues.
Right. And the challenge is on the provider side, unfortunately, and this was part of the conversation I had with this lawyer. It was a great conversation. She knew the space very well. And I guess her rub was that she had no way to fight that part of it. Like, you can't really fight until you get your denial and then you do your appeals, you go through it. But the argument of this isn't a burdensome request or whatever it is, it's not a subpoena. It's not like you're going to court. This is part of the normal course of business that as a Medicare or Medicaid provider, you've signed up to agree to this, right? And I suppose if somebody were to go and say to a provider, hey, I want every single record you've got for the past 12 months, and it's gigabytes and terabytes of data, maybe you have an argument to make somewhere. But the challenge that she was trying to navigate was the time and effort and cost for 12,000 pages. Now, you know, a little bit of my back and forth was, is your provider on an EMR system? Yes. Okay, so the burden really isn't there. You can segregate out your records. You can say, I only want to print them. I only want to PDF the Makachansky records from this date to this date. And it's a PDF, and it's not as much of a burden as it was before EMRs were as cognizant, you know, where people were as cognizant about EMRs as they are. But I think, you know, for her, the argument was, what are you looking at? That's 12,000 pages when it's a non-institutional claim. And, you know, sometimes you have to navigate, and maybe some of that navigation is having a discussion with that provider about, well, what's your, you know, do you have a platform and can you download these things? Because that may help if it's my doctor who I've been going to here in New Jersey for 30 years is still a paper guy, refuses to go on an EMR system because he says the extra couple of percentage points that I might get for meaningful use or interoperability isn't worth the cost, isn't worth it. So when I go for my yearly checkup and he brings in, you know, the chart that's this thick, he says a ream of paper costs me $10 and I could use both sides, so I'm good. You know, like, you know, I get it. Like, I get it. But it does come with its burdens. But Matt, so that then brings us to the next, you know, part of it, which is from a managerial perspective, we have this conversation all the time. You know, we're in the middle right now of doing an SIU scorecard and a review for one of our payer clients. And the question that gets asked all the time is, what's the right number of cases for an investigator? And the answer is always a shoulder shrug, because there is no right number. And I think anybody who says that there's a right number, I'd always love to know how they've determined that that's the right number. If Wade has a caseload of 10 cases, but all of them are very complicated cases with institutional claims, ping-ponging of patients, those 10 cases could be the functional equivalent of 30 or 40. And Wade, we've talked about this. The amount of effort that one needs to put forward on an investigation that's a $3,000 case and a $3 million case could be the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes the argument might be, I kind of jokingly say this, but on a case involving a large volume of records, like institutional claims, home health, hospice, skilled nursing, while we say 30 might be the right number, do we then drop that number to 10 and then kind of have, I don't know, religious connotation to come to Jesus? Or, you know, do we want to have a knock at the F out? We're going to do a 10 record review and we're going to provide you with education and training. How do you have to, from a managerial perspective, we don't want cases in an SIU space languishing for 2, 3, and 4 years. They shouldn't. You might have instances where you're having appeals and fights. I'm helping one of our clients right now where they sent me a letter from a lawyer from 2021. It's 4 years later and they're still fighting this provider and their lawyer. And so I'm helping them with understanding what the lawyer's positions are, trying to understand their positions, kind of doing this separate third-party analysis. It's going on for 4 years. And it involves DME and it's $1 million. Like we're fighting, we've spent more money arguing this than it is. But there has to be this line of demarcation and understanding from a managerial perspective, like where is this all fit in? Because an ADR could, for, you know, on the provider side, it could be a burden. On our side, it could be disastrous and really grind things to an absolute halt.
Yeah. And, you know, going back, you know, what's the right number of cases? It's the cases, you know, that you can handle efficiently and effectively, and that's going to vary by investigator and their skill level and their experience, as well as there is a continuum of cases and their complexity. You know, there's professional services, E&M cases, those types of things that are simpler than hospice, home health, and all that. And it's the only way you're going to know what the right number is doing case reviews and seeing why is this languishing, why is this sitting there, and all that. And one of the things you'll see is always a contributing factor is, you know, waiting for the medical records or waiting for the medical record review to be completed, you know, where the case is stagnant, but you know, it's still on the plate of the investigator and they're still trying to work it. And some of the things that go into that problem is they don't take into consideration what type of case it is and where that case falls on not just the continuum of complexity, but on the continuum of remedies. You know, what is the behavior of the provider that raised this to the specter of becoming an investigation? Is this a first-time offender? Is it, you know, is it a small dollar amount? Is it over a limited amount of time? All those things should be taken into consideration when you're deciding what's the end goal here. Do we want this provider to stay in the system? Do we want an overpayment? Do we just want to educate them? Is this a possible referral? And those types of decisions need to go into how you approach the medical record request. You know, do I need 30 records to just educate a provider? Or can I ask for 10, even on a simple case, and get the thing in and out, education letter, put the provider on notice. Hey, you know, this is what we saw. We're not popping you right now for much, but we're going to keep you on our radar. If we see this next time, it's going to be more. You know,
right.
And that's one way to try to decrease the time frames within which these medical reviews take place, is reduce the number. And there are other ways to do it. Even when you're doing statistical sampling, shape your frame to the facts of the case. If you're going to need, you know, 25 nursing home records to make your extrapolation, you know, supportable, shape your frame to where maybe it's smaller time frames for those claims, or if it's a home health right. or hospice thing, one billing period or two billing periods per patient rather than 6 months or a year. Make those things smaller. So all of those decisions go into at the beginning.
That's a great point is narrow. So you might have a fraud case. The point being, you might have a fraud case and the data might support that this has been going on for 3 years. Maybe you only look at 1 year. And when you're talking to the provider, you could say empirically, look, your billing pattern hasn't changed in these 3 years. We took a small subset as a snapshot. So that's where it's the F around and find out, right? Or knock it the F off kind of an, you know, they call it FAFO. That's the new word the kids are using. F around and find out. But there is something to be said about that. You know, the other thing that I've heard of some plans doing is when they find a provider that's an outlier, and, you know, it's not terrible, but they're clearly an outlier, is they kind of send like a shot across the bow. Dear provider, we've identified your claims as being outliers for the following reasons compared to your peer group. Those are typically very straightforward templated letters that are very much based upon an empirical analysis of data to peer studies. And that's why I always say when I do training on the provider side, know your data, because everybody else knows your data. And just because you're an outlier, outliers are not implicit of a fraud, waste, abuse, or compliance issue if you have a reason that you can explain it. You know, the example I always love to give is I'm a general ophthalmologist and I bring a retinal specialist in who's going to do a whole bunch of types of services that I never did. Well, all of a sudden, my claims are going to go up like a hockey stick for certain CPT codes that I never used before. What if a new technology comes out and the provider decides I'm going to do this? I had this on a project we worked on here a couple of years ago. Ophthalmologist bought a TCD, transcranial Doppler machine, never used one before in his life. He gets one, all of a sudden, he's an outlier for transcranial Dopplers because all of a sudden, all of his patients had the number one diagnosis required for it. Like, you know, these are things that are going to be problematic. But as we kind of run out of time and wrap up, the piece that I really want to touch on, Matt, is how do you impart to the investigators? Like, you obviously got to impart it early on in someone's career, but there's this, you know, the constant refresher training of, we all have this in our heads. We look at 3 years of billing data. We see 3 years of a history of this problem, and we are dogs with bones. And we want to know, this is when this started. This is when it's going on. And it's okay, you know, again, using Kenny Rogers, no one to hold them, no one to fold them. It's okay to take a narrower snapshot and say, look, we know we're not going to get dollar for dollar for 3 years anyway. We're going to settle this for probably some, you know, whatever that percentage is. if we're doing it on a dollar for dollar, we go to the provider and say, look, for 12 months, it's $200,000. The documents show what this is. If you'd like us to go back 3 years, we can go back 3 years, but we really want to make this an education and training. It's part of that, and you talk about this all the time, is case reviews with investigators to be able to keep them educated, to stay focused on, this isn't a four-year investigation. This is 90 days, 6 months, whatever it may be. We have a regulatory requirement. We have whatever it may be. It's making sure that people in leadership roles are always staying vigil to those things.
Right. Yeah. The case reviews, the case oversight is, and I said it when I was an IG supervisor, the most important person in any organization, SIU, OIG, is the ASAC, like Wade, or the team lead in an SIU that actually is managing the workload of the investigators or the agents in their team. Because without that person figuring out, you know, what is the right number of cases per person, and are these cases moving forward effectively, and what is the ultimate ROI coming out at the end, whether that be referrals to, you know, to justice for the OIG, or referrals to law enforcement and overpayments for an SIU. Are those things happening on a consistent basis, or are there sticking points along the way that are causing these agents or investigators to bog down and get stuck? And then it's, you know, then it's your job. What is the root cause of all that? Is it that these ADRs are too broad, or the subpoenas for the IG are too broad and causing delays? Is it that we're asking our nurse reviewers or our auditors to do too much, and that's causing those delays? All those things contribute to what the, you know, to the workflow and the pipeline of the cases that are under the leadership of those team leads. And without constant QA and oversight of those workloads, you'll see those problems pop up constantly. Because agents and investigators, they do want to get to, well, this is 3 years of fraud or 3 years of overpayments. I want to get those 3 years.
Right.
When you'll be just as effective if you do 2 years and you handle twice as many cases.
Right. And I think, and that's an important piece of it, is, you know, you can't have a situation where you've got so many cases that you're overwhelmed with cases, which means that all you're doing is documenting what you've not gotten to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And that becomes the balance. So, you know, look, an important thing, again, they call it an ADR. It's not always an ADR. It's not always an additional document request. If documents haven't been requested, it's just kind of what it's called. It tends to be a term of art, because it's not just in the Medicare and Medicaid space. We see it in our commercial space. We see it all the time. So, you know, the number one thing to understand is that you're when you get these requests as a provider, there's very little control you have over what they're asking for at that moment. It's a little bit different with a subpoena, because a subpoena is a legal instrument and lawyers can go and get them enforced, get them argued. It's too broad, it's too burdensome, whatever. It doesn't mean that you can't go and negotiate with the SIU for a smaller subset. You could still try to do that. It's part of that plan. But, you know, we're focusing today, and we're talking about from the SIU perspective, it's really understanding, you know, be careful what you wish for. Is, you know, if you're looking at a case and you learn that it's 12,000 pages of records, the amount of time that it's going to take to look at 12,000 pages of records. So when a provider's lawyer calls you and says, hey, I got this request for 20 patients, it's 12,000 records, can we talk about it? Have an open mind. Have an open mind to be able to think about, maybe if it's 6,000 records, is it still a problem? Or maybe the way you push back is, isn't your client using an EMR system? Isn't it digitized? Can you PDF it? Like, work with them before you have a knee-jerk reaction of, no, I want 12,000 pages. The lawyer's reaction or the provider's reaction is always going to be, this is too much. This is, they're always going to, it could be 3 pages. It's too much. It's kind of just understanding where that all fits in. So food for thought, again, 30 records is what we like from the PIM, right in the middle, but sometimes you have to make an adjustment. And sometimes it might be worth making that adjustment and document your adjustment. If you're normally doing 30, if your policy says normally 30, whatever it is, and you're making an adjustment, document it. Spoke with provider's attorney, notified me that the 30 records were going to amount to 12,000 pages, discussed a reduction from 12, you know, 30 patients to 10 patients. What does that look like? Just make sure you document everything so that later on someone doesn't come back and say, you broke your protocol. Here's a reason why. You can at least go back and discuss why it is. So stay vigilant. That's all we could say. So we've got
and
a lot
of
good
stuff. And I will
say
negotiating at the beginning makes it easier to settle at the end because you've not, you know, you're working with the provider from the beginning.
Yeah. It's a great point. If you're willing to negotiate early on, a little bit of give and take, and then it does bode well for a settlement, and it does start to open up that door to resolve this case, move on to the next one. And again, these are for cases, by the way, in which you may not be looking to make a referral to law enforcement. If you're looking to make a referral for law enforcement, a lot of this is going to be inconsequential because law enforcement is going to do subpoenas anyway and do all of that stuff. So good stuff. We got a lot of LinkedIn Lives coming up. We just posted our next LinkedIn Live, I believe, in May. We're going to be doing a BH-related one with two of our subject matter experts in the behavioral health space. Behavioral health still continues to be problematic or not, depending upon who you're talking to. So we've got that coming up. Newsletter still every Friday comes right to your inbox along with the OIG Roundtable. You can get it delivered in. I got a few messages over the past couple of weeks from people asking some questions about some prior OIG roundtables and things of that sort. A few people tell me they listen to it on their drive home or their drive to work. So it's nice to know that we're with you during the day. We're with you at the end of the day. So keep listening. We really enjoy bringing you this content, and we'll see you next week on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you.